prohibited cheerleading for illegal immigration. Cheerleaders, our team is awesome. But seriously, you have to admit that Duke has a better basketball team than Yeshiva. Cheerleaders, no, Yeshiva rocks, we rule. How else can one explain the Times responding to a surge of hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants into the country by calling for Congress to grant them amnesty, and with passion? According to the Times, Obama's most urgent priority in response to an invasion along our southern border should be giving these children lawyers and caregivers. This wasn't run-of-the-mill liberal insanity. A few days earlier, Washington Post editor Charles Lane wrote, "Only by showing people there is nothing to be gained by paying traffickers for the traumatic voyage through Mexico will the chaos cease." Of course, Lane hadn't been bailed out of bankruptcy by Carlos Slim. The Times changes its tune. If the lunacy of the Times editorials doesn't grab you, how about the fact that the newspaper has become noticeably hysterical about illegal immigration since Carlos Slim came on board? In 1997, the pre-Slim days, the Times had editorialized, "Fighting illegal immigration is a difficult and important job, but Congress should do it in a way that will deter illegal entry at the border." Another editorial that year complained that the Immigration and Naturalization Service had done a poor job of keeping out illegal aliens, deporting criminals, and processing requests for asylum. This wasn't even Bush bashing. Clinton was president. Post-Slim, the Times tends more toward deranged hectoring in favor of illegal immigration. In the Times' 2014 Go Big editorial, the one insisting that Obama grant permanent residence to illegal immigrants streaming across the border, the Times sniped, "Republicans will howl over Mr. Obama's solo actions. Let them." The Times should never stop hearing about Carlos Slim. By all the rules of the left, you're not supposed to trust someone beholden to a rich man, especially one with a specific interest in public policy. If Slim had saved any company in the world other than the New York Times, his sleazy insider deals and business model based on mass illegal immigration to the United States would absolutely be a problem. But you forgot something. We're the New York Times. We're the good guys. You're not factoring that in. Solving the servant problem. From Carlos Slim to urban professionals, ethnic activists, greedy churches, and Republican lobbyists, no one who supports mass immigration does not benefit financially from it. New York Times sugar daddy Carlos Slim is just a particularly repellent example of the bald self-interest behind the demand for a never-ending tide of poor immigrants to the United States. Don't you understand? People on Wall Street are about to have to pay minimum wage for a nanny. It's not about loving Hispanics. It's about cheap servants. Republicans are terrified of saying anything about immigration for fear of being called racist. It's kind of lucky for American billionaires, and one Mexican billionaire, that the vast majority of our immigrants are Latin America's poor, not Poland's poor. The fact that most immigrants are Hispanic provides excellent cover for the elite's monumental self-interest. Here's a tip for the GOP. Don't talk about the illegal aliens. Talk about Carlos Slim. Talk about rich Americans finding a solution to the servant problem. Talk about one-hit wonder Mark Zuckerberg underpaying his computer programmers while 32% of American graduates in STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, can't get jobs and the rest haven't seen their salaries rise for more than a decade. Talk about how Bill Clinton couldn't find someone to be his attorney general because of the prevalence of illegal alien employees in households of the 1%. Determined to appoint a woman attorney general, Clinton kept producing women with illegal alien nannies. In the end, he had to get around the rich's dependence on cheap domestics by nominating Janet Reno to fill the spot. Clinton first nominated Zoe Baird, an in-house lawyer for Aetna Life and Casualty. Then it turned out Baird had employed illegal aliens, Lillian and Victor Corderos, as her household's nanny and chauffeur. The media ferociously defended Baird, explaining how commonplace illegal alien workers were in professional households. "It's just a reality of life," one head of an employment agency told the Times, "that without the illegal girls, there wouldn't be any nannies, and the mommies would have to stay home and mind their own kids." Are you grasping the full horror of the situation? Another employment agency admitted it was just about saving the rich money. No matter how you slice it, the reason that people hire immigrants without papers is that they're looking to save. If they want legal, they can get it, but it costs. Baird, for example, who was making $500,000 a year, got two illegal alien servants for $42 a day each, plus room and board. The Times cheerfully described illegal alien help for the rich as a pragmatic arrangement, linking illegal immigrants and middle-class homes. The newspaper said that, as more American women with young children moved into the workplace, the demand for housekeepers increased exponentially. Notwithstanding the Times' heartfelt defense of the rich and their maids, Americans responded by deluging the Capitol switchboard with enraged calls assailing Baird's employment of illegals. The phone calls were running 50-1 against her, according to Democratic Senator Howard Metzenbaum of Ohio. It was left to Senator Joe Biden, Delaware Democrat, to explain to the Clinton White House that most Americans do not have a retinue of illegal alien servants. Baird was forced to withdraw her name from consideration and return to her $500,000-a-year job. The Corderos were not so fortunate. Solely on account of the ruckus over Baird's nomination, they were forced to return to Peru under threat of deportation. And thus ended the humanitarian crisis in Peru as far as Zoe Baird was concerned. Even after seeing what had happened with Baird, Clinton's next nominee, Kimball Wood, also had an illegal alien nanny. In three interviews for the job, twice by White House counsel Bernie Nussbaum and once by the president himself, Wood flatly denied that she had a Zoe Baird problem, apparently on the grounds that when she first hired her illegal alien, Trinidadian nanny, it was not technically against the law. In her withdrawal letter, Wood kept obtusely insisting that she had not broken the letter of the law. The elites just can't grasp that most Americans raise their own kids, make their own beds, cook their own food, and drive their own cars. A decade later, another pro-illegal immigration activist saw her nomination go up in flames over an illegal alien employee. President-elect Bush chose Linda Chavez as his labor secretary, but she was forced to withdraw when it was revealed that she, too, had hired an illegal alien domestic. Defending the rich's need for cheap labor, Chavez said, "I do believe that Zoe Baird was treated unfairly." But it's great for the rich. The push for mass immigration from developing countries has nothing to do with solving world poverty. It would be an odd way to do it. I know, let's move all the poor people to American suburbs. According to the World Bank, 2.4 billion people, about a third of the Earth's population, live on less than $2 a day. Until the world economy reaches perfect equilibrium, and there is no reason for anyone to move from one country to another, billions of desperate people will want to come to America. We can't take them all, so which billion of the starving masses are liberals going to exclude? Will it involve death panels? Are liberals going to trample on the right of Bangladeshis? They're dying of cholera. Is it their brown skin liberals don't like? Sorry, liberals, but your white picket fence sense of America and fear of foreigners can't hold back the 2.4 billion in this worldwide humanitarian crisis. Our current immigration law's preference for destitute people from backward cultures is merely a convenience for the 1%. The elites will be gung-ho for a fence just as soon as every college graduate, at least from one of the better schools, can afford a maid, a nanny, a chef, and a gardener. At that point, the elite will stop pretending to care about the world's poor. America will be Brazil with a well-pampered, itty-bitty upper class amid an ocean of poor people. Half a century of Kennedy's immigration law already has us well on our way to becoming a nation of have-everythings and have-nothings. Fabulously wealthy towns like Malibu, California, Atherton, California, Woodside, California, Greenwich, Connecticut, New York's Upper East Side, and Palm Beach, Florida are lily white and getting whiter. But in the rest of the country, once white towns are going majority Hispanic like dominoes. Van Nuys, California, San Bernardino, California, Oxnard, California, Shelbyville, Kentucky, Danbury, Connecticut, Monroe, North Carolina, and Siler City, North Carolina, home of the Andy Griffith Show's Aunt Bee. It's a sweet deal the elites have. They get to have cheap nannies and lawn boys in the whitest towns in America and feel morally superior at the same time. What's not to like about that? Immigration isn't about rescuing the 2.4 billion people of the world living on less than $2 a day. It's about enriching the already rich, who like to laugh at blue-collar people being ground down by cheap labor. It's about Carlos Slim, Zoe Baird, Kimba Wood, Mark Zuckerberg, and Sheldon Adelson getting richer. It's about the gilded class being able to afford a battery of servants. It's about ethnic activists increasing their power and media desirability. It's about Democrats winning a permanent political majority. And it's about Republican officeholders pleasing their well-heeled donors and clinging to power at least for a few more years. What use does New Jersey Governor Chris Christie have for an out-of-work roofer when Mark Zuckerberg wants to be his friend? The only people not benefiting from immigration are ordinary Americans. But who cares about them? Certainly not the New York Times. They just want to keep Carlos Slim happy. Spot the Immigrant, Case Number 4, Indian Sex Slaves in Berkeley. One may imagine Marsha Poole's surprise when she was driving through Berkeley one day in 1999 and saw a group of Indian men carrying an oddly shaped, rolled-up carpet to the back of a van. As Poole continued to watch, she saw a woman's leg fall out of the carpet. Nearby, other men were trying to drag a crying Indian girl into the same van with the rolled-up human body. Poole tried to intervene, but the head Indian yelled at her to butt out of a family affair. Then, at the sound of police sirens, all the Indians scattered, leaving her alone with the van, the rolled-up body, and the crying girl. As Poole was telling the police what she'd seen, the Indians returned, one by one, as if they happened to be strolling through the neighborhood. Oh, look, a van with an unconscious 13-year-old girl rolled up in a carpet. On closer inspection, the police found not only the girl in the van, but another young female body in the building's stairwell. The head Indian turned out to be multimillionaire real estate magnate Lockie Reddy Bali Reddy. He told the police that the girls were his nieces. Their roommate, the crying girl, had come back to their shared apartment, which he owned, to find them unconscious. All three worked in his restaurant. So the girl called him, and the big happy family was in the process of transporting the girls to a hospital in a rolled-up carpet. The girl in the stairwell was dead. Both victims had suffered from carbon monoxide poisoning, though the one in the carpet later recovered. Would any of this seem at all suspicious if white men were caught doing it? It was not suspicious to the Berkeley police. In a flash of investigative genius Inspector Clouseau would admire, the policewoman on the scene allowed Bali Reddy to translate for the crying girl, who did not speak English. Amazingly, she confirmed his story. Lieutenant Cynthia Harris, chief of detectives for the Berkeley Police Department, later acknowledged that, in hindsight, we should not have done that. How does Chief of Police Harris sound, Cynthia? Reddy was assessed a fine for the carbon monoxide leaking from a broken heater in his building, and that was the end of that. As far as the police and the media were concerned. Lockie Reddy, Bali Reddy, another immigrant success story. Except then, a local high school journalism class decided to investigate the story. Not having attended Columbia Journalism School, the young scribes were unaware of the prohibition on committing journalism that reflects poorly on third world immigrants. Thanks to the teenagers' reporting, it was discovered that Reddy had become a multimillionaire by using H-1B visas to bring in slave labor from his native India. Dozens of Indian slaves were working in his buildings and at his restaurant. Apparently, some of those brainy high-tech workers America so desperately needs include busboys and janitors. And concubines. The pubescent girls Reddy brought in on H-1B visas were not his nieces. They were his concubines, purchased from their parents in India when they were 12 years old. The 64-year-old Reddy flew the girls to America so he could have sex with them, often several of them at once. We can only hope this is not why Mark Zuckerberg is so keen on H-1B visas. The third roommate, the crying girl, had escaped the carbon monoxide poisoning only because she had been at Reddy's house having sex with him, which, judging by the looks of him, might be worse than death. As soon as a translator other than Reddy was found, she admitted that the primary purpose for her to enter the U.S. was to continue to have sex with Reddy. The day her roommates arrived from India, she was forced to watch as the old, balding immigrant had sex with both underage girls at once. She also said her dead roommate had been pregnant with Reddy's child. That could not be confirmed by the court because Reddy had already cremated the girl in the Hindu tradition, even though her parents were Christian. In all, Reddy had brought 7 underage girls to the United States for sex, smuggled in by his brother and sister-in-law, who lied to immigration authorities by posing as the girls' parents. Reddy's high-tech workers were just doing the slavery Americans won't do. "No, really, we've tried getting American slaves. We've advertised for slaves at all the local high schools and didn't get a single taker. We even posted flyers at the grade schools asking for prepubescent girls to have sex with Reddy. Nothing, not even on Craigslist." Reddy's slaves and concubines were considered untouchables in India, treated as subhuman, so low that they are not even considered part of Hinduism's caste system, as the Los Angeles Times explained. To put it in layman's terms, in India they're considered lower than a Kardashian. According to the Indian American magazine, India Currents, modern slavery is on display every day in India. Children forced to beg, young girls recruited into brothels, and men in debt bondage toiling away in agricultural fields. More than half of the estimated 20.9 million slaves worldwide live in Asia. Thanks to American immigration policies, slavery is making a comeback in the United States. A San Francisco couple, active in the Indian community, bought a slave from a New Delhi recruiter to clean house for them, took away her passport when she arrived, and refused to let her call her family or leave their home. In New York, Indian immigrants Varsha and Mahender Sabnani were convicted in 2006 of bringing in 2 Indonesian illegal aliens as slaves to be domestics in their Long Island home. In addition to helping reintroduce slavery to America, Reddy sends millions of dollars out of the country in order to build monuments to himself in India. The more money Reddy made in the States, the Los Angeles Times chirped, the more good he seemed to do in his hometown. That's great for India, but what is America getting out of this model immigrant? Slavery? Check. Sickening caste system? Check. Purchasing 12-year-old girls for sex? Check. Draining millions of dollars from the American economy? Check. Smuggling half-dead sex slaves out of his slums in rolled-up carpets right under the nose of the Berkeley police? Priceless. High school reporters break the case. He would have gotten off scot-free with no one the wiser, except for a high school journalism class. Remember, the truth about Reddy's human smuggling racket was broken not by the San Francisco Chronicle, but by a high school newspaper, the Berkeley Hijacket. Even after high school kids did the work American reporters just won't do, the media ignored the story. The New York Times never wrote about Reddy's slaves, unless we're counting a brief reference to Reddy's use of H-1B visas, thousands of words into an article on the difficulties employers face in bringing high-tech workers to America. You've heard about Officer Darren Wilson shooting Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. You've heard about the non-existent rapes at UVA, the Duke Lacrosse rape case, and that ridiculous woman carrying a mattress around on her back at Columbia University. You've heard that Senator Kirsten Gillibrand claims male senators spoke in sexist language to her. Now ask yourself, why have you never heard of Lock Reddy, Bolly Reddy? Republicans still fighting Democrats over slavery. Not just the media, but government officials refused to acknowledge that Reddy had done anything wrong. He's diverse. America is too white bread. Slavery is colorful. The appropriately named federal prosecutor, John Kennedy, allowed Reddy to plead to a few counts of tax and immigration fraud and to the importation of 2 underage girls for sex. For this, Kennedy recommended a sentence of 6 years. 6 years! Before having his sham conviction overturned by the Texas Court of Appeals, former Representative Tom DeLay was facing 3 years in prison for putting campaign funds in the wrong account. The Republican-appointed black female judge, Sandra Brown Armstrong, apparently thought 6 years a bit lenient for slavery and ordered the lawyers to come up with a longer sentence. Pressed to the wall, Kennedy recommended 8 years, which is all that Reddy got. It's one thing for people in Reddy's native village to consider him a king, but did the American prosecutor have to? The American Civil Liberties Union took Reddy's side in the child rape slavery case. ACLU attorney Giashri Sirkantia strenuously argued that any sentence longer than 6 years was too harsh for a model citizen like Reddy. Nothing says American civil liberties like a 64-year-old Indian importing little girls for sex. Reddy still lives in California, as do his pimp brother and sister-in-law. So do all of Reddy's victims, and not just his victims in America, but his victims back in India, who had never been to America. In order to bring a case that ended in a lousy 8-year prison sentence, government officials traveled to India to locate more of Reddy's child rape victims. They were all brought to America and given asylum, despite the fact that none of them would testify against Reddy. Indeed, a few years into Reddy's sentence, 5 of his concubines came to court to praise Reddy and urge his early release from prison. So that was a great deal for America. We got the Indian pedophile. We got his H-1B scams. We got a caste system that defines some humans as untouchable. We got a bunch of girls who think it's normal for their parents to sell them to a 60-year-old man for sex, and who even defend the pedophile. As the Los Angeles Times put it, these girls don't understand just how abhorrent sexual abuse of minors is in U.S. culture. I'm so happy to have them as my fellow Americans. It bodes well for the future of our country. Chapter 14. Every single immigration category is a fraud. The vast majority of all legal immigrants, 2/3, get in on family reunification policies each year. In other words, America has no say about the single largest category of immigrants, and we end up with gems like Octomom, the Boston Marathon bombers, and 100,000 Somalis in Minnesota. Entire villages from Pakistan are dumped on the country, based not on their expertise in nuclear engineering, but because everyone in the village is related to the first guy who got in. If they're not, in the strict sense, related, they'll lie. In 2008, the State Department suspended the family reunification part of the African Refugee Program because DNA testing showed that only 20% of family members were actually related. We'll still take as many refugees from Africa, but they won't have to lie about being related anymore. The government can't even police marriage fraud. It's a felony to engage in a sham marriage with an immigrant, but no one ever gets caught. In 1997, a 30-year-old, down on her luck, two-time divorcee, married an 18-year-old Ethiopian man and was suddenly $5,000 richer. That seemed totally believable to our immigration officials. The immigration marriage was exposed as a scam only when the woman turned up in Oregon 15 years later as the Democratic governor's first lady. By then, it was too late to prosecute. Forget revoking the Ethiopian citizenship. Muslim terrorist farm workers. The Special Agricultural Amnesty of 1986 is a good example of how even the most reasonable-sounding immigration law will inevitably be turned into a pipeline for criminals, welfare cases, and terrorists. As Congress debated the amnesty bill, newspapers were full of stories about beleaguered farmers with crops rotting in the fields who were sick with worry that the law would rob them of the migrant workers who are the backbone of the field labor force, as the Los Angeles Times put it. Coming to the rescue was then-Representative Chuck Schumer. Words that should chill you to the bone. Illegal alien farm workers who could prove they had done seasonal farm work for a total of 90 days between May 1, 1985 and May 1, 1986 would be granted temporary legal status. What could go wrong? In the first 3 years of the program, 888,637 agricultural amnesty applications were identified as fraudulent, but only 60,000 of those were denied. Overwhelmed with amnesty applications, under just this one provision, the INS found it to be a big time saver to simply ignore fraud. As one longtime INS employee explained, since documentation wasn't required, the burden was on the government to prove the aliens were not farmers. Fraud was widespread and enforcement virtually impossible. Consequently, more than 800,000 deceitful applications for amnesty were granted. Among the fraudulent farm worker amnesties approved by the INS was one from Egyptian Mahmoud Abul Halima, or, as he was known in the terrorist community, Mahmoud the Red. Mahmoud had come to the United States as a tourist from Germany, where he had been denied political asylum, but got around that by marrying an emotionally disturbed alcoholic and then married another German woman after divorcing the first when she objected to his taking a second wife. At the end of 1985, Mahmoud and his second wife took a 3-week trip to the United States on tourist visas and promptly settled into an apartment in Brooklyn. Luckily for Mahmoud, just as his tourist visa was expiring 6 months later, Schumer's farm worker amnesty became law. So Mahmoud submitted an application claiming to have worked on a farm in South Carolina, despite having never left New York except one short visit to the Michigan Islamic community. Mahmoud was approved. Otherwise, crops would rot in the fields. And what a wonderful agricultural worker Mahmoud was. He became a limo driver in New York, where he repeatedly had his license suspended for ripping off customers and speeding through red lights because he was busy reading the Quran. But exhibiting that can-do spirit we so admire in immigrants, Mahmoud simply drove without a license, delighting his customers with the Arabic sermons blaring from the car's tape player. 2 years after receiving his farm worker amnesty, Mahmoud was granted temporary legal residence in the United States. For the next few years, he repeatedly flew to Pakistan for combat training. In 1990, Mahmoud became a U.S. permanent resident. That was a big year for Mahmoud. In 1990, Mahmoud busied himself driving Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, the terrorist known as the Blind Sheikh, who managed to stay in the United States by repeatedly applying for asylum, murdering Omar's chief rival, Mustafa Shalabi, suspected, crime unsolved, providing the getaway car for El Said Nosair after he assassinated Rabbi Kahane in Brooklyn, although Nosair ended up jumping in the wrong Arab's taxi. 3 years later, Mahmoud was one of the main conspirators in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, which blew a hole in the skyscraper 5 stories deep, cratered the ceiling of a PATH train, killed 6 people, injured thousands, and caused $500 million in property damage. Mahmoud then fled the country, leaving crops to rot in the field. He was captured by the Egyptians, tried in the United States, and convicted. Without her husband's terrorist income to support her, his German wife now lives on welfare in the United States. Mohamed Salame, another terrorist convicted in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, was also in the United States because of Schumer's special agricultural worker amnesty. The unskilled 19-year-old first came to the United States on a tourist visa because, as the U.S. consulate later explained, someone in the office took a chance on Mohamed. Mohamed not only had never worked on a farm, but he was not even in the country until 1988, 2 years after the special amnesty became law, although it was explicitly limited to those who had worked on farms in the United States in the year before May 1, 1986. By the most basic definition of the law, Mohamed was not eligible, but he was allowed to stay in the United States and obtain a work visa while the INS processed his petition. Moving with the lightning speed of a government agency, the INS rejected his petition for amnesty as a farm worker 3 years later. Then Mohamed applied for a general amnesty, claiming he had been living continuously in the United States from 1982 to 1986. Actually, he was a teenager in Jordan then, but again, Mohamed was allowed to stay while the INS considered his request. As it was considering, Mohamed bombed the World Trade Center. even if someone at the INS had promptly rejected his application, noticing that Muhammad only arrived in the United States in 1988, he still couldn't have been deported. Schumer had included a provision prohibiting the INS from taking any action against any immigrant who merely applied for agricultural amnesty. That might discourage fraudulent applications. No matter how laughably fictional, Muhammad's request for a farm worker amnesty immunized him from deportation. He would still be setting off bombs as a frustrated farm worker had he not returned the van used in the bombing to the Ryder rental agency to get his deposit back. Gosh, we really are getting the smartest immigrants. The ringleader of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing was Ramzi Youssef. He came to the United States without a visa, but claimed asylum and was released into the country. He got a free immigration lawyer from the white shoe law firm Wilkie Farr and Gallagher. With pinpoint timing, 1 year before the World Trade Center bombing, committed by a couple of farm workers, an asylum seeker, and several tourists, the New Republic published an indignant screed about the heartless stormtroopers at the INS who see their jobs as enforcement rather than providing public services and immigration benefits, in the words of Ignatius Bao of San Francisco's Coalition for Immigration Reform. Not so high-tech workers. What about all those brainy, high-tech H-1B immigrants that Senator Orrin Hatch keeps telling us about? The media gush about the legions of star performer immigrants, but suspiciously they always list the exact same ones. All white, all male, and all of British, Dutch, German, and Russian stock. Peter Thiel of PayPal, Palantir Technologies, etc., born in Germany. Elon Musk of X.com, Tesla, etc., born in South Africa to a Canadian mother and a South African-born British father. And Sergey Brin of Google, born in Russia. None of them came to the United States on H-1B visas. For an objective view of high-tech immigrants, the New York Times turned to Vivek Wadhwa, who boasted that over half of Silicon Valley tech startups and a quarter of those nationwide were founded by immigrants. It's probably not a coincidence that Wadhwa did not say what fraction of these startups were either successful or original. There are lots of Me Too startups ripping off investors and adding nothing to the economy. Wadhwa excitedly added that a majority of Indian and Chinese immigrants who go home want to start a company. Yes, and a majority of girls who go to Hollywood want to be movie stars. Wadhwa said it was troubling that 47% of all U.S. science and engineering workers with doctorates are immigrants. If doctorates in science or engineering are so important, why don't any of the stars in Silicon Valley have one? A lot of the biggest names, Gates, Jobs, and Zuckerberg, don't even have undergraduate degrees. As long as the media hide the details, it's easy for Indian-American Wadhwa to claim that, quote, the next Google could well be cooked up in a garage in Guangzhou or Ahmedabad. Where are all the Indian Googles and PayPals now? This importation of cheap tech workers has been going on for decades. Already 65% of all high-tech visas go to Indians. 65%! The next largest category of H-1B visa holders are the Chinese, filling 12% of the slots. We better be getting a few Asian geniuses. But judging by the articles they write, Indians' main talent is self-promotion. Ron Banerjee, another objective source, gloats in the Financial Post that the wealth and success of Indian immigrants is undeniable. In the International Business Times, Harry Chandan Arkelai asks, India's startup scene, will VC dollars create the next Amazon? The Washington Post's Vinod Dom says, Indian engineers on H-1B visas have contributed significantly to advancing innovation in high technology. Yet another article about how awesome Indians are, written by Nisha Bhupat, is titled, How Indians Defied Gravity and Achieved Success in Silicon Valley. Apparently, Indians think they're just peachy. If white Americans expressed this much regard for themselves, it would be racist. Here's how such an article might read. How white men defy gravity and achieved success in Silicon Valley. Did you know Twitter was created by four American white men? Yes, Jack Dorsey, Evan Williams, Biz Stone, and Noah Glass defied gravity and achieved success in Silicon Valley. All white Americans. How about these companies also created by white American men? Netscape, Jim Clark and Mark Andreessen, Mozilla Firefox, Dave Hyatt and Blake Ross, Netflix, Mark Randolph and Reed Hastings, Oracle, Larry Ellison, Bob Miner and Ed Oates, Apple Computer, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. The adopted Jobs' biological father was a Syrian immigrant admitted under the pre-1965 Immigration Act. Pandora, Will Glasser, John Kraft, and Tim Westergren. Zillow, Richard Barton. Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales. Craigslist, Craig Newmark. Uber, Garrett Camp and Travis Kalanick. Technically a Canadian white man. Zynga, Mark Pincus, and Yelp, Jeremy Stoppelman and Russell Simmons. The list goes on. Why, the next Google might well be cooked up in a garage in Fort Benton, Montana, or Camden, Maine. If you think about it, white men have actually accomplished quite a lot. The cheap labor advocacy group, Partnership for a New American Economy, excitedly tweeted that two, yes, two, of the five LinkedIn founders were, I quote, born in Europe. They were born in Germany and France. Here's my counter tweet. 98.7% of the founders of important Silicon Valley companies were born in America. 99% are white men. H-1B visas, indentured servitude. One person to analyze H-1B visas, who's not in it for either cheap labor or ethnic chauvinism, is Professor Norman Matloff, who's been writing about so-called high-tech visas for years. He says, quote, "The vast majority of H-1Bs, including those hired from U.S. universities, are ordinary people doing ordinary work, not the best and the brightest. On the contrary, the average quality of the H-1Bs is lower than that of Americans. We're not going to get the guys who designed the Indian nuclear bomb. They're doing fine in India. Why leave?" The main advantage of foreign labor over native workers, Matloff explains, is that H-1B workers are indentured servants. They can't quit without risking deportation, so American employers get to pay less for standard computer programming work. You can imagine what a huge cost saver that is. Foreign workers go off in cubbyholes, type away at their code for 12 hours, then collapse. Tons of Americans could do the same work, but the problem is they want to be paid. Employers know they have these workers over a barrel, business professor Sankar Mukhopadhyay explains. They aren't going to demand a raise during those 6 years of green card sponsorship, even if they deserve it, and they aren't going to move on to another company, because they know doing those things will jeopardize their chances of getting their green cards in time. As Benjamin Franklin said in 1751, the main advantage of slaves and indentured servants isn't that their work is better, it's worse. It's that, quote, "slaves may be kept as long as a man pleases, whereas hired men are continually leaving their master." Calling Jason Richwine. Microsoft's Bill Gates pleaded with Congress to give him more cheap foreign workers, claiming computer giants like Microsoft were just trying to bring in smart people, and that H-1B visa holders were so immensely qualified that their salaries started at $100,000 a year. Then it turned out that only 12.4% of Microsoft's H-1B holders were paid as much as $100,000, mostly lawyers and other executives. Even worse, since the introduction of the H-1B visa, Microsoft has been laying off American workers by the bushel. Intel's chairman, Craig Barrett, must have needed a thesaurus to write his op-ed on the brilliance of H-1B workers. He called them the world's top talent, highly educated workers, working in high-need jobs, in highly skilled professions, valuable foreign-born professionals, including badly needed researchers, scientists, teachers, and engineers, highly educated graduates, the top minds, driving innovation and economic growth, professional talent. Then Barrett used the H-1B program to fire American workers and replace them with underpaid foreign workers. If Gates, Barrett, and the rest of them really want the world's top talent, where were they when Jason Richwine was being crucified for proposing that we do just that? Quite obviously, high-tech employers neither seek nor desire smart people. They want cheap people. Mass immigration advocates push ethnic stereotypes about high IQ immigrants, but then go crazy whenever anyone suggests we actually bring in a high IQ immigrants. As long as we must be incessantly hectored about Indians as high IQ computer whiz kids, let's take a look at their IQs. You can't play the high IQ game when it suits your cheap labor interests, then cry racism when those claims are examined. The average Indian IQ is staggeringly low, 82. That's about the same as the average IQ in Afghanistan, 84, Panama, 84, Dominican Republic, 82, Paraguay, 84, Yemen, 85, Pakistan, 84, and Tonga, 86. Yet we take more immigrants from India than from Canada. In fact, we take more from India than from Canada and Great Britain combined. We take more immigrants from India than from Austria, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, Greece, Iceland, Ireland, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Sweden, Switzerland, Spain, and the Czech Republic put together. Why are we discriminating against Canadians, British, Danes, Swiss, and Swedes? The answer is because those immigrants would tend to fill the kinds of jobs rich people have. Immigrants are always great, unless they might take your job. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg isn't looking to bring in people who will take his job. He wants immigrants to take his employees' jobs. It's so obvious what employers like Gates, Barrett, and Zuckerberg are doing that even Public Radio International has noticed. In a story about H-1B visa workers abused by their American employers, PRI quoted one who said, "I'm being paid less, which sucks for me, and it also sucks for American developers, because I'm a threat to them. I am cheaper." Indentured servitude was abolished in America in 1867, 2 years after the 13th Amendment was ratified. Henceforth, all employees would have the right to quit. It didn't matter if the employment contract was entered into voluntarily. If a worker couldn't quit, it was serfdom, prohibited by the Peonage Act of 1867. The great abolitionist senator, Republican of course, and future Vice President Henry Wilson, cited the example of New Mexico after it eradicated the wretched system of indentured servitude. Peons who once worked for $2 or $3 a month, he said, are now able to command respectable wages to support their families, elevate themselves, and improve their condition. Democratic Senator Charles Buckaloo said that the inability to quit resulted in conditions that were always exceedingly unfavorable to the employee, adding that the system degrades all, both the owner of the labor and the laborer himself. So more than a century ago, everyone agreed, no more indentured servitude. But today's employers have conspired to bring it back with H-1B visas. Then they strut around like they're Martin Luther King by invoking the magical word immigration. Immigration covers a multitude of sins, because we have all agreed to pretend mass immigration from the third world is the same thing as black civil rights. In the 1960s, leftists were at least self-destructive. They wanted to damage the country in ways that would hurt them, their parents, and their kids. The new left has found a way to be self-righteous only after checking to make sure they've completely exempted themselves from the destruction they're wreaking. Liberals will pull every string imaginable to prevent their own kids from having to compete with immigrants, and then demand cheap employees for themselves. The middle class and lower class take it in the shorts, and the elites get to feel noble. Chapter 15. Shut It Down. The only thing that stands between America and oblivion is a total immigration moratorium. There's no possibility of quick fixes. The entire immigration bureaucracy has to be shut down. It's evident that the government can't be trusted to use 3 brain cells in admitting immigrants, so its discretion has to be completely revoked. No matter how clearly laws are written, Government bureaucrats connive to confer citizenship on people that a majority of Americans would not want to let in as tourists, much less our fellow citizens. Instead of trying to do the sorcerer's apprentice thing, mopping the floor while the water is still pouring in, we need to stop the inflow, then take time to assimilate the immigrants already here. No other fix will work. Congress could just insist that immigrants pay taxes, learn English, not collect welfare, and have good moral character. Except the problem is, it already has. All those laws were swept away by INS officials, judges, and Democratic administrations. Doing it again won't produce a different result. We trusted the government, and it screwed up. We can't even expect our immigration officials not to make citizens of convicted felons. Tens of thousands of immigrants have been granted citizenship after being convicted of crimes in the United States. And no, you can't see their names or read about their crimes. A year before the 1996 presidential election, the Clinton White House worked feverishly to naturalize 1 million immigrants in time for Clinton's re-election. Criminal background checks were jettisoned for 200,000 applicants, so that citizenship was granted to at least 70,000 people with FBI criminal records and 10,000 with felony records. Murderers, robbers, and rapists were all made our fellow Americans, so the Democrats would have 1 million new voters by the 1996 election. In 2013 alone, the Obama administration released 36,000 convicted criminal aliens, with about 88,000 convictions among them, including 426 for rape and 193 for murder. They'll soon be your fellow citizens, too. Usually, we only find out about all the convicted felons our government is making citizens when there's a political scandal. But it's a daily practice. Consider this small news item from 2011. Twice in one day, the Border Police arrested Mexicans who had previously been convicted of sex offenses against children in the United States. Neither of the men's original child sex convictions made the news. The truth came out only when the Border Patrol accidentally mentioned the convictions in press releases about their rearrests. One was illegal alien Eduardo Rodriguez Lopez, who had been convicted in the United States for sex with a child and deported. The other, Antonio Batista, was a U.S. citizen. He had previously been arrested for human smuggling, sex assault on a minor, and sex abuse. What does it take to be turned down for citizenship in the United States? Send the leftists back to Peru. Even if we could trust the government on immigration, and again, we can't, there are the legions of immigration lawyers, lobbyists, nonprofits, and general miscreants whose single-minded mission is to turn America into the third-world hellhole of liberal fantasies. Everyone in the entire immigration apparatus is working frantically to bring the hardest cases to our shores. Left-wing traitors, who used to honeymoon in Cuba and fight with peasant revolutionaries in Peru, bring endless lawsuits to ensure every genocidal Rwandan can get on the American gravy train. Immigration lawsuits are decided by judges who come from the same nonprofits, and Democratic-appointed federal judges issue lunatic rulings to ensure that there will never be a pause in the transformation of America. The country won't be safe until the following outfits are out of business: the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Freedom Network, the National Immigration Forum, the National Immigration Law Center, the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild, the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, the Office of Migration and Refugee Services, the American Immigration Law Foundation, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, the Border Information and Outreach Service, Atlas DIY, the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, the Clearinghouse for Immigrant Education, the Farmworker Justice Fund, grantmakers concerned with immigrants and refugees, the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, the Immigrant Support Network, the International Center for Migration, Ethnicity, and Citizenship, the Lesbian and Gay Immigration Rights Task Force, the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, the National Association for Bilingual Education, the National Clearinghouse on Agricultural Guest Worker Issues, the National Coalition for Dignity and Amnesty for Undocumented Immigrants, the National Coalition for Haitian Rights, the National Council of La Raza, and the National Farm Worker Ministry. Look at that list and ask yourself if it is possible that anything short of a total immigration moratorium can save this country. And that's just a fraction of the anti-American immigration groups. The billion-dollar immigration industry has turned every single aspect of immigration law into an engine of fraud. The family reunifications are frauds. The farm workers are frauds. The high-tech visas are frauds. And the asylum and refugee cases are monumental frauds. Why do we always get last pick in the global refugee draft? The biggest scams in immigration law are the humanitarian cases. 100% of refugee and asylum claims are either obvious frauds or frauds that haven't been proved yet. The only result of our asylum policies is that we get good liars. Taxpayers subsidize sleazy immigration activists who coach immigrants to lie to immigration officials. Document mills produce phony passports, school records, and medical reports. Often, asylum applicants know nothing about the country they claim as home. As the New York Times described the asylum con, quote, West Africans claim genital mutilation or harm from the latest political violence. Albanians and immigrants from other Balkan countries claim they fear ethnic cleansing. Chinese invoke the one-child policy or persecution of Christians. Venezuelans cite their opposition to the ruling party. And Russians describe attacks against gay people. Iraqis and Afghans can cite fear of retaliation by Islamic extremists. Don't worry, Carlos Slim's money stream is not affected by the asylum cases. One Russian woman claimed asylum on the grounds that she had been persecuted because she was gay. When her lawyer asked her to elaborate, she huffily told him, "I'm not gay at all. I don't even like gay people." To weed out the frauds, we'd need a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist to investigate each individual asylum claim. Someone like, say, the New York Times' Nicholas Kristof. A few years ago, Kristof wouldn't shut up about Somali Mam, a Cambodian victim of sex trafficking. Mam claimed that as a child she had been beaten and prostituted by her abusive grandfather and sold to a brothel, where she was tortured with electrodes hooked up to a car battery. But in a testament to the human spirit, Mam escaped from the brothel and went on to found a multi-million-dollar organization to combat child sex trafficking, all of which is recounted in Mam's international bestseller, The Road of Lost Innocence. After a decade of tributes, honors, awards, and gobs of donations, Mam turned out to be full of crap. Her childhood friends, contacted by Newsweek, described her as a happy, pretty girl with pigtails who was well-known and popular in their small village. She lived with her parents and attended village schools all the way through high school. At least Long Pross, one of Mam's rescued Cambodian child prostitutes, was real. As Kristof described her in a column titled, "If This Isn't Slavery, Then What Is?" quote, "Glance at Pross from the left, and she looks like a normal, fun-loving girl with a pretty face and a joyous smile. Then move around, and you'll see where her brothel owner gouged out her right eye." Then it turned out she had lost her eye during eye surgery on a non-malignant tumor. Newsweek even had the medical records. It took a decade of Mam touring the world as an internationally recognized celebrity for her deceptions to be exposed. She had been one of Time magazine's 100 Most Influential People, interviewed by Oprah, feted at Manhattan and Beverly Hills soirees, and embraced by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, actress Meg Ryan, and Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg. How is a U.S. immigration judge supposed to do better? How specifically are U.S. officials going to investigate claims of gang rape in Nigeria? They don't. They just grant asylum. Knowing full well that asylum is the most fraud-ridden of all immigration programs, which is saying something, immigration judges approve 92% of all credible fear asylum applications. Nafese tu Diallo. The only ones that ever get disproved are the ones where the asylees somehow become famous. Hotel maid Nafese tu Diallo became an international sensation when she accused the head of the International Monetary Fund, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, of raping her at the Sofitel Hotel in New York. That turned out to be just another immigrant get-rich-quick scheme, but her rape claims brought unwanted attention to her asylum application. It turned out Diallo had cooked up the yarn about being gang-raped in her native Guinea in order to win asylum in the United States. The whole thing was a fairy tale she had memorized by listening to a tape given to her by an American immigration activist. If Diallo hadn't made a spectacle of herself by trying to shake down the IMF chief, no one would have ever been the wiser. Diallo, of course, is still in the United States collecting welfare. Amadou Diallo. Another Diallo whose asylum application was exposed as a pack of lies only after he became famous was Amadou Diallo, shot by four New York City police officers. While looking for a violent Bronx rapist one night in 1999, the cops shouted at Diallo to put his hands up, but he didn't obey because he didn't speak English, and he wasn't sufficiently familiar with American customs to know that when police officers are shouting and pointing guns at you, the best practice is to show them your hands. Only because Diallo got himself killed for not speaking the language did we find out about all the immigration frauds he had committed to be here. He first got to America by falsely stating he was a student, though he never attended any school in the United States. After arriving on a student visa, Diallo was granted asylum based on his claim that he was from Mauritania and his parents had been murdered by the government. In fact, he was raised in a well-to-do Guinean family and had lived in Bangkok and Singapore as a child, traveling with his father's job. After Diallo's death by lack of English skills, his allegedly murdered parents suddenly materialized and demanded $61 million from New York City taxpayers. The city gave them $3 million, at that point the largest wrongful death settlement in New York history for a person earning less than $10,000 a year. Why were hardworking New Yorkers forced to bear the cost of a problem that was caused entirely by incompetent federal immigration officials? Four cops' lives were nearly ruined because an immigrant who didn't speak English scammed the system to stay in the United States. Even before the shooting, Diallo wasn't a major boon to the country. He eked out a living selling baseball caps, tube socks, and bootleg videotapes on East 14th Street in Manhattan, clogging up the sidewalk and engaging in intellectual property theft. No American media outlet would ever admit it, but any legal immigrant making less than $10,000 is collecting food stamps as well as other government benefits. With the money they received from New York taxpayers, Diallo's parents built a computer lab in rural Guinea. Despite the pain it must cause them to be reminded of their son's death in America, both his parents now live here too, the better to denounce American police officers. Federal officials whose salary you pay give away American citizenship like a consolation prize. Diallo's cost to America. Millions of dollars in immigration and criminal court costs, judges' salaries, welfare payments, a $3 million settlement, in addition to the cost of government attorneys to work out the deal, and the loss of four good officers to the New York police force. Benefits to America. $0.00. Edwin Bulis. Another asylum applicant became famous only because the New York Times decided to champion his cause. In 1997, the New York Times ran a Pulitzer bait story about Nigerian political refugee Edwin Bulis, who said the Nigerian government is bent on genocide against my entire family. I'm afraid that, like others, I will be killed. He said he became a target of Nigerian political authorities after his brother, Happy Bulis, attempted a military coup. Edwin himself was part of the pro-democracy movement at the University of Lagos, having become, quote, very inquisitive about political ideologies like those of Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Thomas Jefferson. Somehow, Edwin managed to escape and flee to America, using documents he admitted were fake. When he arrived, he said, he found out both his parents had died. Dr. Hancock, a government psychiatrist, diagnosed Edwin with depression. Quote, he sits with his hands in his lap and his head bent, Dr. Hancock observed, making some eye contact, but often apathetic and appearing dejected. Edwin blamed himself for his parents' death, saying, I just pray they rest in peace. But instead of finding sanctuary in the United States, the Times said, Edwin had ended up in a Kafkaesque web of INS bureaucracy. Guards at the detention facility had thrown out his papers, the very papers he needed to make his case. Not only that, but they had, quote, stomped on him, forced him to kneel naked for hours, pushed his head in a toilet, left him to sleep naked on a bare mattress, and subjected him to racist invective. Still, Edwin's many supporters had high hopes. Edwin was going to receive another hearing as soon as his cousin could send a photo ID card and affidavits attesting to the fact that Edwin was Happy Bulis's brother. His asylum application was supported by everyone: Amnesty International USA, the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center, a government psychiatrist, and a law firm in Nigeria. An immigration official who had interviewed Edwin for 2 hours found him credible. And, of course, it had to help that the newspaper of record was broadcasting his story. Alas, instead of shaking up the INS, the Times inadvertently shook out the truth. The Nigerian acting consul in New York read the Times article. So did a businessman visiting from Nigeria. And so did Nigerians living as far away as Australia and Oregon. It turned out that Happy Bulis did not have a brother named Edwin. Edwin had never attended the University of Lagos. Edwin's parents were alive and well. Happy's parents were alive and well, and none too happy about this imposter using their family's name. Edwin's name wasn't even Edwin. It was Mutaru. The only reason Edwin's lies were exposed was because the Times believed every word he said. Of course, anyone could have been fooled by a wily deceiver like Edwin. When confronted with the discrepancies in his story, Edwin claimed that there must be two lieutenant colonels named Happy Bulis who were arrested for plotting military coups against the Nigerian government. The issue before me, he said, is a double identity clash. His immigration lawyer believed